with information on the latest developments in assistive technology and initiatives from the studios of 2RPH in Sydney, RPH Australia brings you AbleQuest. Hello, I'm Marnie Roper. We are being encouraged, as a population, to work longer and accept that the new retirement age will move from 65 to 67. Not so for one of today's guests. Barry Gow retired from his position as a cardiovascular physiologist with the idea of growing grapes for wine, but instead embarked on a completely new career path. Now 81, having invented a groundbreaking research tool to aid the implantation of bionic eyes, he is still working as an honorary visiting associate professor at the University of New South Wales. And this was all done in his home shed, which he has set up as a finely tuned scientific workshop. And even more amazing is his practical and economical approach to the development of this tool, which is made from items readily available in the local hardware store. We tracked down Barry Gow and his colleague, Greg Swanning, who is a professor in the Graduate School of Biomedical Engineering at the University of New South Wales, and who runs the Bionic Eye program. Barbara Sullivan spoke with them via conference phone at the university.
Barry and Greg, welcome to AbleQuest. Now, you're both working on a research instrument that could help restore some vision to people with degenerative retinal conditions, the wonderfully named Wongiscope. So, first of all, Barry, how did you come up with that name?
It was just the result of me doing most of the work in Wongi Wongi in New South Wales. The word got coined after a while, and other people were using it, and it appeared on minutes and things like that, and it suddenly took on a life of its own.
Names have a habit of doing that, don't they? Exactly, in layman's terms, what is it meant to do and how does it work?
Its function is to actually produce a picture or an image of the retina in experimental animals in which has been placed stimulating electrodes towards the bionic vision project.
I understand it's basically built from inexpensive, commonly available devices. Can you talk to us about that?
Yes, it had a long period of evolution of trying all sorts of things that didn't work, but ultimately I found that a fairly inexpensive web camera had the ability to capture the image, and providing that I used infrared so as I was able to actually see the stimulating electrodes and penetrate through the tissues of the eye, but also it required a certain amount of tinkering with the optics so as I could get a wider angle viewer. And it turned out that the lenses within a door viewer, or peephole, some people call them, did the job. So it was just very fortunate that I was able to use something fairly inexpensive.
I would call it a stroke of brilliance rather than very fortunate. But you use the word tinkering then. It sounds to me as if you're very good at creating something from very practical things. You did this in your workshop. How long were you actually developing it for?
I think it's something about 7 or 8 years from the day I first heard about the need for such a device. So it's just that the advantage of this project, which was offered to me by Greg, was the fact that I've been able to do it on my own terms. In other words, I've been able to do the work at home because I've got the facilities there, and I don't particularly want to come to Sydney every day of the week. So it's been very fortunate. I'm grateful that they've been indulgent with me, because it's taken a long while.
Well, for every inventor of something like this, there are breakthrough moments. What were yours?
The breakthrough moment, I think, was when I'd obtained a sheep's head from the abattoir.
Sheep's head, right.
I was not too far away from Curry Curry, where they slaughter animals. I was able to get a sheep's head home within an hour when it was fresh.
Sheep's head.
Which is very important because they do deteriorate the eyes unless you look after them. I was able to tinker and to try out various optical devices, and I tried the camera out in that situation. And using infrared and beaming infrared in, the whole thing sort of lit up. I was able to see the stimulating electrodes, which otherwise would be invisible.
Now, you mentioned that it's largely developed to help people with retinitis pigmentosa. For the benefit of listeners who aren't particularly familiar with this condition, can you explain it very briefly?
Well, I can say this much about it. It affects about 1 in 4,000, if I remember correctly, and it's a condition in which the photoreceptors, these are the cells of the retina, which turn light into electrical signals. In the people that have this disease, these photoreceptors no longer exist, and they're just left with the what they call the retinal ganglion cells, which are the cells that they ultimately connect to. Because these people have functioning retinal ganglion cells, you're able to use an electrical stimulus to stimulate these cells and send a signal to the brain.
Not that age is the issue here, Barry, but I have to confess that I'm very impressed that an 81-year-old would be spending his retirement working in a different field and inventing such a life-changing research instrument. Tell us how you came to be doing this. You alluded to it a little bit earlier.
Well, essentially, my first degree was in dentistry, but went on to cardiovascular physiology after that and did that for most of my career at Sydney University. After that, I decided to retire at the end of 94, ostensibly to grow grapes and have a hobby vineyard and go sales. But there was another factor there, because when I retired, I had a collaborative project working with Professor Klaus Schimpelm, and we arranged that I could come down a day a week and be involved in the supervision of a student. So that kept me going to the university once a week and then on. What happened after that was that around about 2008, my collaborative projects dried up, as it were, ready to go at that point. But one of the people here suggested I might like to talk to the bionic vision people and offer my services, not knowing what I would be doing. And that's when I met Greg. And he presented me with this problem that when they put the stimulating electrodes into a cat, they couldn't see them. So they needed some way of doing this. So that's how it started.
So, Greg, since it's your program, your staff and students have been testing and working with the Wonderscope. Tell us a little bit about that, and have they come up with any modifications after testing?
It was delivered to us in an advanced state to the point where we really didn't have to make many modifications or any modifications to it. Barry has been working with me for many years, asking questions while we're doing the surgery and taking notes, and then going off to his workshop on the Central Coast and coming back the next week with another finished product that's even bigger and better than before. So we gave Barry this project that we had absolutely no idea how the solution would end up, and Barry came with a reputation of being able to solve impossible things. So we gave him this project, and I gather that he was in his element in his workshop up on the Central Coast, polishing things and making his own epoxy colorings and various things. So it really has changed the way we were able to do the research, because when we put this bionic eye in, there's no outward sign of this device. It's not like an antenna or anything that you can see.
Yes.
And it sits behind the retina, and it really is invisible. In fact, if you look into the eye even, you don't get to see it. But Barry came up with some wavelengths that penetrated the tissue, and you could actually image this electrode array that we put in behind things that you could normally never see through.
So it sounds like you're fairly far along with it. How are you conducting trials?
We had a very large grant from the federal government from 2010 to 2014. Within that period of time, we had many, many advancements, the Wonderscope being one of them. But we also got to the point where there were three people in the city of Melbourne that were implanted with electrode arrays. They weren't implanted with bionic eyes. They were simply the electrode arrays, where we had 20 little dots of platinum. And we asked the patients what they could see. And one of the patients in particular could see quite a lot with just 20 dots. So that gave us a lot of encouragement. So our device has 98 channels, or really 99 technically. And with that many channels, you can start to form shapes and images that you couldn't otherwise do with fewer channels. Mm. So we've gotten to the point now where we've finished the design. We've tested the design in many ways, including implanting them in sheep and then seeing how well the sheep perform. And is getting to the point now where the next step is to collect the relevant information to ask the regulatory bodies to be able to go and test this in a very small human trial. And we have some generous funding from the National Health and Medical Research Council that begins in 3 weeks, and that task that we've been given is to complete a clinical trial within 4 years.
That's excellent, because the original BVA, Bionic Vision Australia research funding only lasted about 3 years, didn't it? And so after that, you had to fund yourselves, did you?
That's right. It was it was a bit of a cliff from boom to bust, really. We had about 20 people working on the project one day, and then the next it was back to Barry, Nigel Lovell, and myself. A bit of a shock. I had to turn on the lights in my own laboratory for the first time in 5 years, so it's actually quite sad. But gradually we've had some generous donations from people that allowed us to hire one more person. Then we had some success with a smaller grant, and then we had the National Health and Medical Research Council that came to the party. So we're gradually building the team back up again, and things are going very well. It really is an expensive operation, but now it's starting to boil now.
So would anyone else use the Wandsha scope other than you in your research work there? Other research organizations likely to use it?
I suppose they could have use for it if they have the same problem that we have. Now, this is quite a unique problem where you've implanted something that there's no way to look at. Suppose you could x-ray it, but that's a cumbersome thing. You have to develop the x-rays, and it takes ages to get the result. We need to know right now, where is this thing? Has the surgeon placed it in the correct location? There's a group in Korea that is using a similar approach, and I know they'd be quite interested in having such a device that would basically, during the surgery, allow them to see where they've placed the electrode array. Because really, you make a small incision in the eye, and you slide this electrode in, and you essentially hope for the best that it's going to be in the right place. Now, the surgeons that we have working with us are extremely skilled, and they can get it in the right place every time, but you want to confirm that. So anytime you need that confirmation, the Wandsha scope could do it.
So there's no commercialization of the Wandsha scope. It's just going to be refined and maybe replicated, but not on any sort of commercial basis?
Our secret weapon.
And it's a big competition, is it, the bionic eye development?
It is. So there are, I'm going to guess, around 8 groups around the world that are pretty serious about it. There are probably about another 10 that are doing aspects of research, not necessarily making a device. But it's heating up. There are actually people that do walk around with bionic eyes in Europe and the United States. They're a mixed bag of results. Probably not what you would call impressive yet, but they haven't had ours yet.
It's fantastic to think, Barry, that so much of that will have come from all your good work up in Wandsha Wandsha in your workshop.
It's been nice to help. I don't want to blow the importance of my instrument up to equal the importance of the overall project.
We'll look forward to drinking some of your wine when it comes on the market after you've applied your wonderful practical skills to grape growing.
Sadly, Barbara, that's been and gone.
Oh, dear. So,
I drink other people's now.
Where to from here, Barry? We've heard about the clinical trials and the new funding and so on. What's next for you?
I have another year of my contract here as a visiting associate professor. I think it's probably time for me to retire.
Yes, you've said that before. Well, thank you both very much for joining us on AbleQuest today.
Thank you, Barbara.
Thank you.
You have just been listening to AbleQuest, a program that looks at developments in assistive technology. From Barbara Sullivan and Marnie Roper, thank you for listening and goodbye till next program.